Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. I've been doing this program for over 15 years, and I've had the pleasure during this time of reading many excellent books written by guests. I have to say two have stand out in my mind, and neither were written by physicians, medical scientists, or even healthcare experts. Both were written by professional writers. The first is entitled The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature by Timothy Ferris. The other is written by our guest today, Eula Biss. The title is On Immunity and Inoculation. From my point of view, it's an extensively researched, well-reasoned, thorough examination of immunization as an imperfect but important personal and public health healthcare decision. And it also reminds us of a very important truth, that we are neither infallible nor immortal, and that good decisions often require very rational assessment of risk, which it turns out we are not naturally good at doing. And it also reminds us that certainty is a limiting factor. The book On Immunity by Eula Biss was recently selected as one of the New York Times Book Review's 10 best books of 2014. Ms. Biss, it's just a pleasure for you to take the time to be with us today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
I would guess that I know you're being interviewed a lot. Every time I look on the internet, I see new interviews showing up. Many of these appear to be literary, although I also noticed you recently appeared on Tavis Smiley, and I looked at that interview. But I'm wondering how often the medical profession, science profession, are catching a hold or wind of the of this book that you've written and are interviewing you about it.
I've had a couple interviews. I had a wonderful interview with Suzanne Coven, who's a physician who also frequently writes book reviews. She writes for the Washington Post. I probably got that wrong, actually. But we had a great conversation. And then I also recently had a conversation with the Immunization Action Coalition. So I've been speaking a bit to people who are medical professionals, which is, of course, really different than speaking to people who are other writers and are interested in, you know, the writerly aspects of the book.
The typical way to start this line of questioning about the book is always to ask you what led to it. I know exactly what led you to it, but I want to ask that before I move on. I think it's still important.
Sure. Yeah. What led to it was when I was pregnant with my son, so over 5 years ago, about 6 years ago, I decided that I needed to know a little bit more about vaccination. I had heard some vague concerns from friends and people around me around vaccination, but I knew very, very little about vaccination. And so I decided to do a little research into the subject to help me with my decision making there, and that little bit of research blossomed into a lot of research and eventually became this book. Long after I had read enough and learned enough to answer my own personal question, which was, should I vaccinate my child and should I vaccinate him on schedule? Long after that point, I continued to read into the subject because it was so complicated and so fascinating to me. And because it branched into all of these different realms and, this question of vaccination reaches out of medicine into issues of governance and how we interact with our government, and it reaches into issues of the history between women in the healthcare establishment and sexism, and it reaches into all kinds of social territory that I find interesting. There's issues of class and race there as well. So I think the portion of my research that was devoted to just answering my personal questions was briefer than the portion that was just driven by curiosity and interest in this subject and a desire to examine my own thinking on the subject a little more deeply.
So what you were trying to accomplish was not only to expose or to discuss the social and, you know, emotional, psychological, as well as scientific aspects of immunity, but it also was leading you to begin to think about how you think about subjects in general or just immunization specifically?
Yeah, I think both, but I thought at first that I was really just looking at how I thought about this subject, but I discovered fairly quickly that how I thought about immunization was very colored by how I thought about other things. So one of the first things I recognized about my own thinking when I was doing this research is that some of my own reservations around vaccination had to do with my feelings about environmental pollution. And I don't think I'm unique in that regard either, but I made the realization that I was taking some of my own anxieties around pollution of our environment and making a kind of leap of association and assuming that the environment of the body would be polluted in some way by vaccination. Mm-hmm. And the more I learned about vaccines, the less I believed that to be true, but I was still interested in why I'd been prone to that thinking to begin with.
I want to take just a second. I failed to do it at the beginning of the program to let listeners know how they can get a hold of us today. As a reminder, this is Line 1, your health connection from Anchorage. My guest is Eula Biss, author of a book on immunity and inoculation. We're going to be discussing that book in the next 55 minutes or so, and you can reach us with your questions or comments in a couple of ways. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. You know what? I guess that idea of asking yourself or making yourself think about what you believe is become somewhat important to me as well. And I got into it from reading some of the social psychology and some of the research that's being done. And it turns out, as I implied in the introduction, that innately we're not very good at making decisions. We are biased almost unbeknownst to ourselves by how things are framed, which is, I think, what you were saying also. You framed this immunization issue with environmental issues or other issues that may be important or in the headlines and so forth. And those significantly affect our decision-making process. And by recognizing that, however, you can begin to understand how to make better decisions. So that is the part of the book that I thought was very interesting and appealing to me. There are a number of parts, by the way, but that in particular caught my attention.
And yeah, and part of that, I think, is key to the tradition that I'm writing in, the tradition of the personal essay. And this tradition is less about having an opinion or arguing a point than it is about exploring your own thinking and thinking about how you think and why you think the way you think. And, you know, this goes all the way back to Montaigne, the French writer, French Renaissance writer, who is considered the grandfather of the personal essay, who was at that time doing something very radical, which was just writing about his own thoughts. But some of the most interesting research that I did for this book was about risk assessment and as you said, about how poor we are, we meaning all of us, at assessing risk and thinking reasonably and logically and well about risks. And as I was doing that research, I started thinking about the risks that I accept in my own life and where I don't accept risk. And I did observe that my thinking about risk is quite inconsistent and often tips into a space that it would probably be fair to call irrational.
Mm-hmm.
But the most obvious example I could think of was that I can get very concerned about minute risks, but at the same time, the biggest risk probably in my child's life that he faces, consistently is riding in automobiles and being in a car, and that's a risk that I have accepted in his life with very little struggle. You know, I've accepted it because it's part of how we live. Mm-hmm. And but compared to the risks associated with vaccination, the risks associated with riding in a car are tremendous. And when my son isn't riding in a car, he's usually on the back of my bicycle, which is arguably riskier than being in a car. And so I started thinking about, okay, what values are at play when I accept those risks? And with cars, it's usually valuing convenience and speed. When I put him on my bicycle, it's about other things. It's about lifestyle. It's about the fact that that's how my father carried me around when I was a kid. So I want to give that experience to my son as well. I want him to know what it's like to be on the back of a bicycle in the early morning and with the wind through his hair. and so there's a whole little network of values there. And then when I examined my thinking around vaccination, I realized that I was willing to accept a small degree of risk, in part because vaccination supports things that are deeply valuable to me in terms of my social relationship to other people and protecting other people's bodies.
That's another area that you worked into better than I often see it, and that's this issue of how immunity, when done well, confers herd immunity to those who cannot be immunized or, despite immunization, still remain at risk. And it brings up this social obligation, as you stated, and I'm not very good at stating to patients, that we have to protect each other. That's what you're saying there, I think, is...
Yeah. And, you know, I knew about herd immunity before I started this research, but I don't think I really deeply understood what was going on there. And I also didn't understand that many of the vaccines that we give to children are not necessarily meant to protect those children alone in that moment. So, like rubella is an example of that, right? That that my child has been protected already by the time he's born by other people being vaccinated against rubella, because the portion of our population who's most vulnerable to rubella is actually unborn babies. So we're vaccinating the majority of people who are not as vulnerable to rubella to protect that one minority of people who is vulnerable. So in my thinking about this, I felt, my son has benefited from all of these other people around us paying into this system, protecting him before he was born, and now I'm going to have him vaccinated so that he will pay into that same system, protect other people.
Mm-hmm. And the fear of immunizations, as a mother experienced, let's say, prior to your research, was that this was going to be, in a sense, environmentally dangerous to his body, his immune system, among other concerns.
Yeah, I think, you know, as an expectant mother, I was suddenly uncomfortably aware of all of the kind of ambient environmental dangers out there, the pollution of air pollution, which I felt like I had no control over, water pollution, which I also felt like I had little control over, and pollution that somehow works its way into our food, and I felt that there were many routes by which pollution was going to make its way into my child's life and potentially compromise his quality of life. If not compromise his life directly, compromise the environment that he's part of and that he's going to inherit. Mm-hmm. I think I was making a leap between those concerns and feeling like vaccination was just one more place where pollutants might enter his body. And the more I learned, the less that I felt that was true or the case. Right. As you already know, the what people call toxins, so I'm even reluctant to use that word for things that are in vaccines, because I think it's an inaccurate term. But what people think of as toxins and vaccines, the amounts that of those substances that appear in vaccines are so minuscule compared to the amounts that are in other sources of exposure for children. So if we're going to worry about things like mercury and formaldehyde, vaccines really don't make sense as the place to worry about it.
And there's, I assume you must have had this concern of side effects other than environmental exposures to, quote, toxins, unquote, that mm-hmm. has been so prominent. Again, I mean, it's always been an issue of significant side effects, autism and seizures and so forth. Do you recall that being a big issue or not so much with you before the research?
Yeah, this book is made up of 30 short sections, and part of the reason why there's so many sections to the book is as I examined my own fears and reluctances around vaccinating, I discovered that they were manyfold. And so, yeah, I think that the fear of side effects was there, and not being sure what side effects were truly side effects of vaccination and which were things that had been just kind of statistically associated with vaccination. That was confusing to me initially. And then it was confusing to learn that there were things people believed were side effects that science hadn't shown to be side effects. And then I think there was a more kind of overarching concern that maybe this technology had consequences that we didn't know about yet. I felt less concerned about that the more I read and the more I learned about vaccines, in part because I hadn't really realized how old this technology is when I was thinking about vaccinating my son. I didn't realize that we'd been using vaccination in some form for hundreds of years. And I didn't realize that people had been fearful of and resistant to vaccination almost from the moment it came into being. That's what truly gave me pause, is when I was when I was researching the early history of the Victorian anti-vaccination movement in England, and saw that so many of the fears in that place and time were similar to my own fears, and that made me step back, and I thought, there's some kind of interesting historical continuity going on here around what we fear mm-hmm. around vaccination, even though the vaccine in question at that time is no longer used anymore. So that all that resistance was about the smallpox vaccine, which is not a vaccine we use. I didn't get it. My son didn't get it. And at that time in Victorian England, the smallpox vaccine was even given in a way that we no longer vaccinate. So it was given by making a slit in a person's arm and placing the vaccine matter in the person's body and then sealing it in. So I thought, okay, this isn't about needles, and it's not about the specific vaccines in question. It may not actually even be about the particularities of this vaccine or another. It's about some other cluster of fears that this is bringing up for us, meaning me and other people who feel hesitant around vaccines. And so reading that history was in part a way for me to understand what's going on in this time and what was going on in my own mind. And in that history, it's clear that a lot of what was going on for people was also a kind of navigation of personal rights versus states' rights, and a navigation of, you know, what is and is not owed to the social body and to the collective. And people were resisting government power in that time for reasons that are sometimes similar to why people are resisting government power in our time. But they were also very concerned with pollution. Again, though, the kind of pollution that Victorians were concerned with is not exactly the same as the kind of pollution that concerns us now. But I think there's some really interesting similarities. Victorians were concerned with bodily pollution and keeping the blood pure, in part because the purity of the blood meant a lot for Victorians in terms of race and class. So people were very concerned with maintaining their racial purity and maintaining their class-based purity. People didn't like the idea that, say, someone who was upper class could be vaccinated with material taken from the body of someone who is working class. That was disturbing to people. And to us now, I think that sounds a little archaic, but I actually think that there's some similar thinking going on in these days behind the resistance to vaccination. And I have definitely heard people express the opinion that vaccination is for people who are poor, but it's not necessary for or intended for people who are middle class or have good access to health care or who eat well and exercise well. And I think that there's some echoes of that Victorian sensibility in there, that this is only for people who are impure already, or people whose lives are sullied by their economic status. But for those of us who enjoy a higher economic status, this isn't necessary.
I think I would agree, and this is where you brought up some issues that I had not myself run across. I hadn't thought about the socioeconomic disparity issue, although I think about it a lot when I think about public health in general. I hadn't thought about it from an immunization standpoint, and that surprised me. I certainly can see the bias that can be drawn in about personal rights, states' rights, personal choice. It's a common theme, and seatbelts and guns and everything. And there's reasons for people, because of the way governments have behaved, to have that kind of that thought. So that certainly is understandable. I had not seen the socioeconomic class issue myself in the immunization stuff. But that may be my own bias. I came from a background where I was never exposed to that kind of idea at all in any way that I can recall.
Yeah. And, you know, it has actually, since I finished the book, showed up in a few places. The Hollywood Reporter ran a story about wealthy neighborhoods in California where the vaccination rates resemble the rates in third world countries.
Right.
And there has since then been a little more attention going to that phenomenon, as, you know, the resistance to vaccination having something to do with a privileged economic status. And I think it's a kind of complicated relationship, but I do believe it. And I think I think it's something I'm not necessarily proud of, but when I examine my own thinking on the subject, when I was pregnant with my son, I think it's something that I was vulnerable to as well, thinking I never would have said it this way at the time, but this is my interpretation of my thinking now, looking back, that, but my child is special, and my child is entitled to things that other people aren't. And the more I thought into this issue and the more I examined that impulse in myself, the more uncomfortable I felt with it.
All right. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. We're going to take a short break, which we often do at this particular time. If you have questions or comments about my discussion about Eula Biss and her book On Immunity and Inoculation, you can reach us at any time. And again, we'll take your questions and calls after the break. But our local number, once again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and I'll be right back with you. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is essayist Eula Biss, who's written a book entitled On Immunity and Inoculation, a very thorough look at the whole subject of immunity, extremely well written, and has been selected as one of the New York Times Book Review's 10 best books of 2014. Up to this point, we've been discussing her reasoning for getting into the topic and then really getting drawn in a deep way, which led to the book. What I'd like to do now, Ms. Biss, is do something that we don't do on this program, and that's get into some of the arts and literature. I really look forward to this, and maybe you do too. The metaphor is a word that shows up early, quickly, and is throughout the book. Let's assume our listeners are all stodgy scientists, medical people, and don't know what metaphor is. What does that mean? And then I'm going to lead you into some examples.
Sure. Yeah. So metaphor, probably the quickest and loosest definition I can think of is describing one thing in terms associated with another. So Juliet is like the sun. We use metaphor all the time, everywhere. It's not just in art and literature, but in the sciences and everywhere else. It's metaphor is embedded in our language. And actually many words were originally metaphors when they came into being, even if we don't necessarily understand their metaphorical nature anymore. But it's interesting in immunity and immunization and immunology, even the scientific language there is full of metaphors. So, for example, cells in immunology are described as communicating with other cells sometimes making presentations to other cells. They're described as having memories. They're described as sometimes kissing and doing things that we associate with humans. So in that case, the metaphor is we're taking actions that are human actions and using them to understand the actions of cells and to understand what those interactions between cells mean and are about.
I have certainly understand, or I certainly do understand the scientific use of metaphor, even though I may not have understood the reason, the word metaphor, as well as I do now. But I would like to draw you into some of your references, your literary references, which are so good. And I want to start with the first one, which is the artwork on the cover, which I don't remember when it finally dawned on me what the metaphor was there. If you don't mind describing the artwork and the metaphor.
Sure. The painting that's on the cover of the book is by Rubens, and it's a painting of Thetis, who's a Greek goddess, dipping her baby, her infant, Achilles, and that's the Achilles of mythology, into the river Styx. And it's an arresting image, in part because she's dipping him head first. So she's holding the baby by his foot, and his head is underwater in the painting. So it's not the way that a mother bathes her baby. And I think that part of why Rubens made this choice is that that this isn't he doesn't want to show a bath. The act that's happening there is something darker and stranger than a bath. It's Thetis is trying to make her baby immortal, and the infant Achilles is a mortal who's been born to a goddess. And she's distraught over the fact that he won't have immortality, especially so because in mythology, she's consulted an oracle, and the oracle has told her that her child, Achilles, is going to die young. And so for much of his young life, she does everything she can to try to ensure that he won't die young, and this is the first act. Is dipping him in the river Styx to try to ensure immortality. And there's different versions of this story, but in many versions, Achilles is granted an incredible protection against injury by having been dipped in the river Styx. But the place where his mother held him, his heel, is unprotected, and he's eventually killed by a wound to his heel. And he does in fact die young, so the prophecy is correct. And how that painting ended up on the cover of the book is that as I was doing all this scientific research, I was also casting around in other directions and trying to think in general about how we, meaning human beings, think about immunity and what does it mean to be immune, and what are some of the fears that we associate with immunity and the desire to be immune. And one of the first stories I thought of was the myth of Achilles, and in part because I see that story, I think one way of interpreting it, one way of thinking about that story is as a kind of cautionary tale. And the caution there is that no matter how badly a mother wants her child to be immortal, that can't be accomplished. And there will always be some weakness that, you know, that death will find. And there's only so much you can do as a parent to protect your child. And as a new mother, that story was very powerful to me. But it was also in a strange way comforting, in that I felt like, okay, we've been thinking about this since ancient times, and we've known since ancient times that there's only so much we can do. Even if you're a goddess, there's only so much you can do to protect your child. And this led me into thinking about other old and ancient tales that I could think of where parents were trying to protect children or parents failed to protect children. And so that got me thinking on the Grimm's fairy tales, which my mother read to me when I was young. And there's many, many instances in those Grimm's tales of parents accidentally making decisions that lead to some sort of harm for their children. So Rapunzel gets accidentally traded to an evil enchantress who puts her in a tower. And in another story, a miller accidentally gives his daughter to the devil because he promises the devil whatever is standing behind his mill, and not realizing that what is standing there is his daughter. He thinks he's giving the devil an apple tree. So I was thinking about these stories and noticing how one of the cautions in those stories is that parents can make bad deals with fate. And I think that's one of the things that people are afraid about with vaccination, and that I myself was afraid of. I think people are wary of the idea that vaccination is like a deal with the devil, that the promise that it offers is almost too great to be true, that with this simple little shot that is relatively painless and quick and quite inexpensive, you will be afforded protection from disease. And there's something about that seems impossible. And so I think that what follows is that we fear that there will be a punishment for accepting that deal with the devil, and that we'll trade away something that we don't know we're trading. I think that's the anxiety, you know.
Right. It's that it gets back into that decision making, that rationalization of the issue may lead us, for reasons we really don't understand, again, I think, to make the wrong decision.
Right. Yeah, and we've got, you know, centuries, if not millennia, of storytelling cautioning us to be careful around trading on our children's lives. So I think that in many ways it makes sense for people to be wary and cautious in this arena. Though that impulse can lead us to make decisions that are actually dangerous. You know, as you've pointed out, we're not excellent at always making the most reasonable decisions for ourselves or our children. But this is also where metaphor comes back in, because I was reading into myths and fairy tales, but I was also reading Susan Sontag when I was writing this book, and I was rereading Illness as Metaphor. And one of the beauties of that book and the essay that followed it, Aids in Its Metaphors, is that she lucidly exposes how the metaphors we use around a disease can cloud our thinking about that disease and can actually hide truths from us. And metaphor at its best, metaphor is illuminating, and that's why we use it. That's why it's a tool that we can't part with, at its best, there's nothing like metaphor for illuminating an unfamiliar subject. You use terms that are familiar to you to understand something that's unfamiliar, and suddenly a door gets opened. But when your metaphors are flawed or inaccurate, instead of opening a door for your thinking, you can be obscuring a truth. Mm-hmm. And that's what Susan Sontag pointed out so beautifully in Illness as Metaphor, is that there were truths about cancer that were being misunderstood because of the metaphors that we were using to think about it. And actually now for people of my generation, those metaphors have shifted so much, so substantially, and probably in part due to Susan Sontag, that the book doesn't have the same kind of power that AIDS and its metaphors has for me. Because when Susan Sontag talks about the metaphors that we use around AIDS, those are familiar to me. Those I remember from my own life. And the metaphors that she was talking about around cancer, us thinking of it as a disease of excess and things like that, are some of those have left our culture and or aren't as dominant or overpowering. Mm-hmm. But rereading Susan Sontag inspired me to look at the metaphors that were in use around vaccination and to think about, are these metaphors that are illuminating a truth on this subject for us, or are these metaphors that are obscuring a truth? And in order to really know the answer to that question, I had to learn a lot about what's actually happening with vaccinations. So that led me into all the research that I did in immunology and on the immune system and on what's actually happening when someone gets vaccinated. And the more I learned in that area, the more that I felt that many of the metaphors we were using around vaccination were, in fact, quite flawed. And some of them were so flawed that I thought the metaphors were suggesting the opposite of the truth rather than the truth. So part of my project in this book became not just thinking about and talking about the metaphors, but also suggesting new metaphors, ways of thinking that I thought were more illuminating than the ways of thinking that we're used to around vaccination.
So what I'm hearing you say with the use of metaphor, if I can dare touch back into science, is when the psychologists are talking about framing, it's the same way. A metaphor is one way of framing a subject, and how that metaphor is used will bias our decision-making,
mm-hmm.
our thinking about disease, our thinking about vaccinations, and so forth. So if mm-hmm. you were to help the national immunization movement, one of your suggestions might be is to rethink the metaphors that are being used, maybe even by the medical establishment, about immunizations.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, Susan Sontag was particularly critical of war metaphors around mm-hmm. disease, and she was critical in both of the essays she wrote of war metaphors, and her feeling was there are cases where these are accurate, but they're, for the most part, war metaphors aren't that helpful to patients. That was her bottom line. And there's people who disagree with that and people who agree. But I was interested in that point in part because war metaphors are so omnipresent when it comes to the immune system. So it's very difficult, especially for a layperson like myself, to talk about the immune system without using the word fight or ward off, or, you know, all of these metaphors, verbal metaphors of violence come up when we talk about the immune system. And I think that can, like you were saying, prime our minds to be a little more fearful about things that affect the immune system than we need to be. Mm-hmm. And so vaccination becomes a violence in our minds because mm-hmm. all the metaphors we use around immunization or immunity are violent metaphors. And mm-hmm. so it's not that much of a stretch for people to think of the act of immunization as a kind of violence because that's the language that we use in this area. And one really, really interesting moment for me in my research was when I sat down with a professor of immunology who had agreed to just talk to me about the immune system. And he gave me a very basic, here's what's going on in your body kind of talk that, because the immune system is complicated, took 2 straight hours. And in those 2 straight hours, he never once used one of those war metaphors that are so associated with the immune system. And that was fascinating to me. His metaphors were most often metaphors that borrowed on terms from education and from academia, and which isn't surprising because he's a professor. And also, many of his metaphors were gastronomic, so cells ate other cells or digested other cells. But he would also say things like, this is how your system learns. Mm-hmm. And what's going on here is that your system is being tutored by a vaccine. And I was so interested in that new metaphor that he was presenting to me. I'd never thought of a vaccine as a tutorial or a way that my body was learning something. And I think that kind of metaphor is far less fear-based and fear-producing for people. If we thought about vaccines as a kind of advanced education for a child's body instead of a potential violence to their delicate system, I think we'd be far less fearful of them in general.
Yeah, as you were saying this, I came up with a different approach. Would it be using some metaphor, which I'm not good at coming up with, that it's more to help the community and each other, much more of a collective-like benefit, which sounds, mm-hmm. I think, kind of like what you're saying, but didn't strike me immediately the education, which was clearly another metaphor.
Yeah. And the metaphors around community are tricky, too, because I think sometimes people can forget that there's benefit to both the individual and the community in vaccination. So I've heard people say things like, why should I sacrifice my child's health for the good of the community? When that's not really accurate in terms of what's going on. You know, all the data suggests that the individual has as much to gain from vaccination as the collective does. Yeah, another metaphor would be kind of pulling a blanket of protection over yourself and your child and everyone who's going to come in contact with your child. So a large blanket of protection pulled over the community.
I have an email that I want to get you to address, and I'm going to do that immediately. But I want to also tell you we have about 10 minutes, and I have to ask you about Dracula, so don't take too long on this answer. So the question is, what do you think it is about the anti-vaccine school of thought that's made the movement so popular? It seems to have gotten political, fear-based, less evidence-based, any idea why? So what's driving this idea?
I think in part because it's powerful because it plays on fears that are strong and legitimate in other realms. So I already mentioned the fears about what's going on, anxieties about what's going on with the environment. The movement definitely draws on those fears and manipulates them intentionally sometimes. And then people's concerns about the government and the government's role in their lives, that fear gets provoked and again sometimes manipulated by the anti-vaccine movement. And fears of medicine and the unknown. And sometimes fears about the medical establishment are another form that fear of the unknown takes. People feel like this is an area where they don't understand the language, they don't understand necessarily the methodology, and so that's another fear that gets played on by the anti-vaccine movement, and sometimes the medical catastrophes and medical malpractice are used as examples for why we should all never trust anything that doctors tell us or do, which is, of course, not really solid reasoning, but it does appeal to people's most basic fears.
All right, thank you. Now, you can't read your book and not notice that Dracula and vampires show up so often as common topics and metaphors that I have to ask, I'm a little worried about you.
Yeah. Well, so was I. And that was a big surprise. I was not interested in vampires before I began working on this book. But that kind of snuck up on me. And I think it started with discovering that vampires were used as a metaphor, actually, for the vaccinator in Victorian England. So some anti-vaccine activists would distribute pamphlets where they used the metaphor as a vampire, so a bloodthirsty creature that preys on babies, as a metaphor for the doctors who were vaccinating infants. And that got me curious, and I wondered about that metaphor and thought, okay, is the vampire a good metaphor for the vaccinator? And that provoked me to read Bram Stoker's novel Dracula, which is not the sort of novel that I would ever pick up, actually, on my own without some sort of provocation. But it's a truly fascinating book, really interesting, both in the way it's written and in what it's saying. And in that book, Bram Stoker is exploring some of the most recent medical knowledge of his time, which is namely germ theory. And Dracula is very obviously a metaphor for disease in Bram Stoker's novel. And the people who are the vampire hunters of Dracula, trying to hunt him down and stop him from spreading his vampirism all over the world, are doctors, some of them. But they're also metaphors for medicine, and they even use the language of medicine. So when they're trying to prevent him from getting back into his coffins, which he needs to get into in order to recharge himself, regenerate, they sanitize them. And that language shows up in the novel. So it's very much the language of the medicine of that moment. And so that did set off the concerning obsession that you notice in the book with vampires. And it got me interested in looking at other vampires, but it also in looking at the many metaphors that cluster around Dracula. Here's another very enduring story. Dracula is persistent in our culture. He keeps showing up in new movies, new adaptations, new imaginings. So we've got reworkings of Dracula that appear nearly every decade. And one of the things I was curious about is what are we really thinking about when we tell stories about vampires? Are we thinking about disease, and are we thinking about contagion and our fear of disease and contagion? And I think that in part we are, among other things.
Another issue that we've kind of got onto a little bit that I also noticed that Dracula came into is this idea that I talked about at the beginning, and I think your book brings up some important truths, and one of these is this idea of certainty. And to me, it means that as soon as you think you know and you're certain about something, it closes your mind, and you no longer can learn. You're not open-minded. And as I understand it, your mother put it much more succinctly, as I quote here, she told you, you have to erase yourself. Am I understanding her admonition correctly?
Absolutely. And she was talking about poetry there, but one of the surprising revelations of this book for me is how similar good poetry is to good science, in that, yeah, you have to refuse your own assumptions. And you also have to make peace with the fact that your knowledge is always partial and imperfect and incomplete. So I think that sometimes I hear from other parents when I'm talking with them about vaccination, I hear the idea that they won't be comfortable vaccinating until we know everything there is to know about what vaccines do and what side effects they cause. And that's impossible. That isn't how science works. It isn't how art works either, actually. It's just not how knowledge is. We never know everything. And I remember really vividly one of the interviews I did for this book. I interviewed a medical ethicist, and who is also a pediatrician and someone who'd worked with the Institute of Medicine on a major study on vaccine side effects. And the study that she did, or that she was the chair of, found that there are side effects associated with vaccination, but they're quite limited in number and very rare. And so what this study concluded was that vaccination is remarkably safe. And I was talking with her about this study, and I asked her, but do you ever worry that there's things you don't know? And she said, oh, I don't doubt that there's things we don't know. And she said, I'm just not that naive. And if you look at the history of medicine, I can almost guarantee that there's things we don't yet understand or know. And she said, but we're compelled to work with what we do know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is as true for scientists as it is for parents. We're compelled in this moment to work with the knowledge we have and to make the best decisions we can based on what we do know. And I think if you work from that realization with vaccination, the imperative to vaccinate becomes easier and clearer, because everything we know suggests that is the best choice for a child. And there may be things that we don't know now that the people following us in hundreds of years will know, but we don't get to live then. We live now.
We have to make our best decisions with what we've got and clearly thinking. Well,
we don't get to live in the future.
I want to say thanks very much, and I'm again biased by my own knowledge, and I'm going to end with a quote from this attributed to Ben Franklin that follows along this idea that we really need to think clearly, we need to check out our assumptions when we make decisions, and it also establishes this evidence that this idea about problems and concerns about immunizations is long-lasting. In the late 1700s, the early 1700s, Franklin was actually a proponent of not getting smallpox vaccines. And then the following quote is attributed to him. It's in 1736, I lost one of my sons, a fine boy of 4 years, by the smallpox taken in the common way. I long regretted bitterly and shall regret that I had not given it to him by inoculation. This I mention for the sake of parents who omit that operation on the supposition that they should never forgive themselves if a child died under it. My example showing that the regret may be the same either way and that, therefore, the safer should be chosen. Eula, thanks very much. Wonderful book. I recommend it to anybody who's interested in a good read, as they say, on immunity and inoculation. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
I enjoyed it, too. On our next program, Prentice Pemberton is going to host guests from the Covenant House, and they're going to be looking at a three-part series on homeless teens in Alaska, who they are, why they're on the streets, and what can be done to help. So why not tune into Health and learn more next Monday, December 29th. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer to today's program, along with Evan Erickson. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.